Welcome. We are here in the studio of Charles Kramer, and I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to do an interview with Charlie. I know Charlie for a couple of years, and let's go over it, as some people say.
Okay. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Charlie. So what got you into photography?
Well, my dad had a tiny little darkroom that I got to use when I was growing up, and in high school I had a 35 millimeter that I used to take lots of happy snaps of all my friends and could make these lousy little prints. But, you know, all this time I'd been studying music. I went to San Jose State for 5 years, and then I was about to leave for 2 years at the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York, which reminds me of the underlying connection between music and photography. George Eastman founded the Eastman School, but he also founded a company called Kodak, which was headquartered in Rochester. So just before I went away, though, I visited Yosemite for the very first time. And I had never really been almost anywhere up until that point. And seeing the Sierra and all that, it made a big impression on me. So I then went to Rochester and spent all my waking hours in these dreary practice rooms, and all the time dreaming of going back to Yosemite. So I got some books on Yosemite, and that was where I read first about Ansel Adams and how he was originally going to be a pianist also. And that got me thinking. So I was getting ready for the summer when I could go back to Yosemite, and I was going to make some pictures there. And so I needed a better camera. So when I got back, I found a used a press camera, a Super Speed Graphic. It's 4x5, and it's hand-holdable. So on my first trip to Yosemite, I handheld my 4x5 Speed Graphic, and I carried a couple film holders in my pocket, along with the light meter. So it was very portable, but the results were terrible.
You are more known for your color work. How do you see color and black and white photography for your own work today?
Well, when I first started, I did all black and white with a little color. But, you know, back in this is in the late 70s, color wasn't that well developed, and no pun intended. And, you know, black and white was quite a mature art by this time. So I actually did mostly black and white. And around 1980, I had seen some dye transfer prints and, you know, thought that these had a quality that I couldn't achieve with the Ektachrome papers. So I took a leap and got some equipment, and big mistake, started doing dye transfer. And you have no idea what a commitment that is. People asked, you know, they wanted to learn dye transfer, and I said, well, you need first you have to be evaluated by a psychologist, and only if you're nuts will I teach you, because it's so much work. But it enabled me to make prints that you couldn't do any other way. And it's, you know, it had been through its heyday already, and the only people using it were advertising labs ad agencies, because they could retouch the dye transfer prints very well. So it was very hard to learn how to do dye transfer. And I got most every book published, and it still didn't give you that many hints. So you had to kind of like reinvent the wheel. And so over about the 12 or 15 years I did dye transfer, I kept discovering new little techniques, and which was great. But then I'd have to go back and redo a whole bunch of pictures. I kind of drifted into color for a period of time. I actually did both. And my rule of thumb was, you know, when the light's good, I'll do color photography. You know, color is very picky about the lighting situation, especially color transparencies. And for dye transfer, you needed to do color transparencies. So I would, you know, find the shaded areas and such for my color work. And then when the light got bad, then I'd do black and white, because black and white, you know, had such a much larger contrast range. And you know, you can develop the negatives differently to match and to fit all these different contrast ranges in. And in dye transfer, I didn't like to do skies because I guess I just don't like blue. It must be, I'm not sure. Well, the other reason might be that there's so many steps in dye transfer, and that skies, you know, will show very clearly any little dust that gets into the process. That, you know, if you do a sky in dye transfer, you're just asking for trouble. So if you look at Elliot Porter's work, who also did dye transfer, you'll notice he doesn't do many skies either. And I wonder if that was the reason. But in black and white, it was easy to do skies, and you know, they weren't blue. So I actually, people kid me that, you know, I don't like skies. But I do. It's just I don't like blue skies, I guess. Especially blank blue skies. But I love big cloud pictures in black and white. I really appreciate black and white. In fact, some of my favorite photographers are do black and white. But, you know, after you take that first picture and it's in color, it's very hard to get my mind at least back into thinking black and white. With nowadays, too, I think the best way to do black and white is actually to make color originals. And that way you can examine, you know, the red. It's like taking three at a time. You get red, green, and blue filter exposures. So, you know, you can pick and choose which is the best black and white interpretation. But once, you know, it's been photographed in color, I have a hard time going back and extracting the black and white information. But I still have ambitions of doing more black and white work.
Which photographers or other artists have been your major influence?
Well, like I said, most of my favorite photographers really are black and white. I obviously liked Ansel Adams, and Paul Caponegro was a big favorite. That's the father of John Paul Caponegro. He does black and white, and it turns out he's also a musician. Another favorite is Don Wirth. Don used to be one of Ansel Adams' first assistants back in the late 50s. And through a mutual friend who lived in Australia, he actually brought Don and I to Australia on several occasions. And so I got to spend, this is in the early 80s, several months traveling with Don. And it was a wonderful educational experience, and I got to hear all kinds of stories about Ansel. And, you know, Don would go out and travel with Ansel when he worked with him. And so it was kind of like I got to see, you know, a second generation kind of how Ansel would photograph. So that, I think, was a big advance in my both aesthetic and technical skills, hanging out with Don Wirth. And Don is also a musician, as it turns out. Actually composed the score for one of these little films that they did about Ansel back in the 60s, I believe. There does seem to be some kind of connection there between music and photography. Another photographer I think that I like a lot is Michael Kenna, who is just, it's an unhuman, I think, how good he is. Because he just does these small black and white images, and yet each one is so just encapsulate an emotion or a feeling of light just beautifully. And, you know, here I am, and I do color, usually larger prints, so go figure.
Yes. Most of your signature photos are from 4x5 film, but you print for quite a while digitally. Can you talk about this journey from darkroom prints to digital?
All right. Well, I mentioned that I spent large portions of my life in the darkroom with dye transfer. I'm amazed at how much work dye transfer was. You have to make three contrast reduction masks, three highlight masks, three separation negatives, and all these are actually done with black and white film because you're separating all the colors out. That's why there's three of each of those. And then you'd use those to expose the printing plates or the matrix film. That was developed and then dipped into trays of the colored dye and rolled out kind of like silk screening to make the print. And it's only at that point can you see, you know, what you've done with all these steps. And if something was wrong, you have to figure out where it went wrong. So Diet Transfer gave you tremendous control with all these steps, but also lots of places for things to go terribly wrong. So it was tremendous work. But when it worked, it worked pretty nicely. So I did teach Diet Transfer printing for the Ansel Adams Gallery for 3 or 4 years back 88 through 92 or 3. And in 89, one of the people in the class was somebody named Bill Atkinson. And I didn't have a computer then, so I didn't know who he was. But he was very excited about the process and kept going on about, well, he has a friend with a plotter, you know, and maybe they could make a print that way. Or I remember he talked about algorithms that could correct focus problems and stuff like that. But remember, this was like 1989, and so, you know, any scanner you wanted would be hundreds of thousands of dollars. So things just weren't ready. There was no way to make a good print. So I kept doing Diet Transfer. In 94, Kodak killed Diet Transfer. They Kodak supposedly was going to give us 2 years' notice when they were going to stop manufacturing the materials, but they just decided, you know, well, nobody's buying these anymore. I was able to stockpile some materials, but fortunately, also around that time, Bill Atkinson had retired from his full-time job and became like a one-man digital R&D lab. And he would invite me over every once in a while to see, you know, his latest advances, and also to have me make a few prints. And so I remember going over, he had a Creo desktop scanner, and we scanned a transparency, and then he had an iris printer. And you think inkjets are trouble, you should try one of these iris printers. Because I said it was kind of like a pet, because you couldn't leave it for more than 24 hours, because the heads would clog up, and if the heads clogged up, you had to buy a new one, and they were like $3,000. Fortunately, Bill had the maintenance contract, with which cost an arm and a leg, but it was cheaper than buying all these heads. But he made some iris prints for me, and they had some disadvantages. The dot pattern was quite coarse. And, you know, any $99 inkjet printer from Costco now will do a better job. And also their inks, they had incredible color gamut. But unfortunately, they started fading within about 3 to 4 years. So you couldn't sell them. But other than that, it worked great, you know. But the big advance came in 97, I think, when the LightJet laser enlarger came out. And and the other thing was that Fuji came out with their Crystal Archive paper, which suddenly now lasted a long time. So with the two of those together, as a somebody selling photographs in galleries, you know, you could finally sell these LightJet prints. So that was quite an advance, and gradually my Diet Transfer work dropped off, and I've basically been completely digital for probably 10 years now. So, you know, and it just gets more and more exciting. What with the inkjet printers now, you know, being able to print them at home, that was really something. And the prints are so good now, I don't think people realize, those who are just starting out nowadays, you know, how wonderful these prints are. Because 15 years ago, it was almost impossible to get a really good print. I mean, that would be Diet Transfer or perhaps Cibachrome or Ilfachrome. But now, it's almost, I tell people, it's almost too easy.
Okay. You are now using for over a year a digital bag on a Mamiya 645. What is your experience so far, and how does it, the new work, hold up against film?
Well, before I bought the, made the major purchase of this P45 39 megapixel digital back, you know, I wanted to be sure that I was getting something I would use. And Bill Atkinson had previously had the 22 megapixel version of the same back, and we'd done some comparison prints. We'd been out photographing, and I shot the same thing on 4x5, and then him with his 22 megapixel, and I wasn't impressed. Even in a 2024 print, I felt, you know, in certain subjects, that it, you know, it just didn't hold up that well. But when this 39 megapixel back came out, I remember, you know, Bill was interested in upgrading his back. So we went over to Bear Images in Palo Alto and got to test one. So I brought the 4x5 and we shot three or four scenes. Then went home. Well, before we compared thing, I had to have my film processed and then scan it. So it was quite exciting, you know, drum roll, please, when we finally did the comparison. And the differences were actually major. And it wasn't just that this new back had more megapixels. We could see that, it was a whole new sensor. And so the noise had gone way down, even though the pixel size was smaller. And it did saturated colors better. And I felt, I did some 30-40 prints from these test files, and I felt that this was, it wasn't as good as 4x5 in 30-40 print, but I thought that I would be proud to have one of these prints with my name on it. So I bought the thing. And my conclusions now are that in a 24-30 print, that it does as well as 4x5. So I don't think there'd be much difference there. In 30x40, like I said, again, the 4x5 would have a little bit more resolution. But since a year or more ago, the RAW developers have improved. So I can actually get more detail now than I could then. So I'm actually very happy with it. And it's completely revolutionized, the way I make pictures. Because I had always used my 4x5, carrying enough 4x5 film was always a problem. And plus, each sheet of film cost about $3.50, and then processing maybe a little over a dollar. So we're talking maybe $4-$4.50 per exposure. So even doing a bracket, was a little painful, because you try to block that out of your mind, but it's always there somewhere, realizing what this is going to cost you. And actually that, when I saw the price of this back, which I thought was preposterous, but then I figured, okay, I looked back and how much did I spend on film and processing for the last 3 years? And it actually came to about 2/3 of the price of a back. So that's how I rationalized it. So with a 1 year now of using this back, instead of my usual, maybe at the most 500 sheets of film, I've taken, like 6,000 captures. So it's a lot more work on the backside editing these images. But it's been great fun. I'm also very happy. I decided to go with the Mamiya 645 system. And I'm very pleased with their lenses. And the camera could be a little more sophisticated in how it does things, but it does the job, and it's very light, and it holds up well, unlike the I could have bought the Hasselblad for twice as much, and plus it's bigger and heavier, and the repairs, a friend had a lens go out under warranty, this zoom lens, which I hear a lot of them do, and it took 5 weeks to repair. My Mamiya lens had a problem. I sent it came back in 5 days, so I think there's something, Mamiya kind of is poo-pooed by many people, but I think, they've been making cameras for years and their lenses are really quite wonderful.
You join our fifth summit this year in Zion as a guest instructor. We heard that Zion is also one of your favorite places. What makes Zion so special for you?
Well, I think actually I'm intrigued by the whole Southwest and canyons and the Red Rock area. The when I think about why I make photographs, I think a lot of it, if not most of it, is due to the light that is illuminating the scene. I tell people, that extraordinary light can make an ordinary subject wonderful. An extraordinary subject under ordinary light will just be ordinary. So, doing a lot of photographing in Yosemite, I had dreams, when I first decided to do this, that I would go up for the summer and just hike all day in the summer and make pictures. But it turns out it doesn't work that way. That for the best results, the light midday summer is kind of drab, shall we say. So when I've been a part of this group, we got a little funding to do these like 2-week backcountry trips in Yosemite, and it's a very strange schedule because we're up before dawn, you know, like 5 a.m. and getting the first light, and after about 3 or 4 hours, you know, by 9 a.m. maybe even 10 a.m. the light's shot. It's very drab. So we then sit around or read books and kill time until, maybe 6 p.m. when the light starts to get interesting again. So, and basically, with color, we're looking for shaded conditions. So if a storm comes through, you know, or we get overcast, then that works just as well. So unfortunately, though, in the summer, the Sierras just don't get many storms, if any. However, when you go to the Southwest and you start exploring some of these canyons, and I don't mean, you know, the Grand Canyon where it's a huge wide thing, but more narrow canyons like in Zion or, you know, the countless other canyons in there, you can get shade all day because usually if the sun's hitting one canyon wall, then the other opposite side would be in shade. Plus, the sun is hitting this red canyon wall and it's bouncing this warm light onto you, the thing that you're going to photograph. It's wonderful lighting. And so in the Southwest, actually, you can take pictures all day. And actually, you can sleep in, too, because the best light is actually, from 10 to 4, you might say, because that's when you get this bounce light. So even though I've spent much more time in the Sierra photographing, I actually have many more transparencies from the Southwest because it's the conditions are just more conducive to making especially color pictures. So the light there is wonderful. When you do reflections in water, you'll get the blue sky reflected, red rocks, green trees and sun reflected, and so you get these in colors that you just don't see anyplace else. So I find the Southwest a very magical place.
You have a great reputation as a photography teacher, often together with Bill Atkinson. Which role plays teaching in your photography?
When I was going to be a music teacher, I actually spent a whole year studying teaching and with a wonderful teacher there, Adele Levine at San Jose State. And so that was very valuable. And it kind of instills the feeling that, you know, teaching is a higher purpose, really, and something to be not to be approached lightly. And since I was going to be a music teacher, I'm using the same techniques that I've learned in teaching, but, you know, for photography. So I really enjoy teaching, too, and it's exciting to see what people are doing, and it's been a wonderful experience.
Yeah, I very often think it's what you probably do, too. If it's sharing of passion, that's a very different thing than just teaching something. It's not, you know, and I think that gets over when talking to you. You also play the piano and organ. How do music and photography relate for you? You already mentioned quite a while that many famous photographers are musicians, so I feel really bad now.
When I heard that Ansel Adams was a musician and you know, that he revered the fine print practically above everything else, I immediately understood what he was talking about, because making a print is it's almost the same thing as playing classical piano, because in classical piano you have a score and you examine the score and study it and try to figure out what's the best way to bring it to life. And also, you know, a gazillion previous pianists have played this piece, so you need to do something original with it, you know, inject a little bit of your personality into it. So it's practically, you know, word for word equivalent to what you do when you print a photograph, is make it come to life. And the best photographs, I think, are ones that have a little bit of your personality in them, too. So So all these years, you know, that's why I took up die transfer printing, is because I really enjoy the challenge of making the best print that you can make.
Thank you, Edge, for your interview, Charlie.
It's been a pleasure.